The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article is titled Martha Beck's Advice for Silencing Your Inner Critic Once and for All. Maybe you're one of those self-assured people who've never given a hoot what anyone thinks of them. If so, you also probably set fires and hurt small animals because you're a psychopath. Please go away. No offense, it's not that I don't want you here. It's just, wait a second. Actually, it is that I don't want you here. Go right ahead and take offense. Decide that I'm a priggish bitch. I can handle it because I've internalized the wisdom phrased so cogently by Socrates, or maybe it was LL Cool J. How others judge me is none of my business. This statement's plain common sense brooks no denial. Since you can't control other people's thoughts, and since neither people nor their thoughts are perfect, there's no point in living life based on your fantasies of other people's fantasies about you. Got it? Excellent. I'd stop right now except for one thing. Emotionally, we non-psychopaths are built to care what others think of us. It's part of our social primate biology. Our brains are like those surgical theaters with glassed-in observatories. We operate under the constant scrutiny of an imaginary audience. Sociologists call this audience our generalized other. Some generalized others give us a daily dose of support and inspiration. Some can be witheringly cruel. Sadly, even if yours is flat out evil, you can't just will yourself to be indifferent to it. Happily, I've found a way to get it out of your mental business. Your generalized other is actually based on a mental magnification of just a few people, often the most judgmental people you know. To see what I mean, complete each of the following sentences with the first thing that pops into your mind. Everyone wants me to, everyone thinks I'm, everyone expects me to, everyone's always telling me. Now, for each sentence, think of real people who have told you, not indirectly or by implication, but in so many words, that they hold the thoughts and opinions you just listed. These people are part of your generalized other, or as I like to call them, your everybody committee. After coaching hundreds of folks through this exercise, I believe most of us have very small committees, often just one individual, almost never more than six. Yet we subconsciously project their opinions onto the entire global population. Your vague, unconscious guesstimate of your everybody committee's opinions affects your every move. When you hate on your hair or dread speaking in public, you're anticipating your committee's judgment. If you wouldn't be caught dead without your Rolex and false eyelashes, it's because that's what your committee approves. If you consider yourself a rebellious nonconformist, you continually refer to your committee so you can be sure to shock them. Can you say irony? Most of us assemble our everybody committees haphazardly, especially during childhood. We tend to give the best seats to the cruelest people, people who hurt our feelings and undermine our dreams. To avoid attacks from these pernicious trolls, we obsess about living up to their standards. This is a terrible way to live. I speak from experience. Much of my life has been dominated by everybody committees that were totally misaligned with my true self. As a result, I did things that held no joy for me, never felt I was good enough, and believe that if people knew who I really was, they'd hate me. Sound familiar? You too may live in fear of being rejected by your everybody committee if you set out to live your best life. And you know what? Your fear is well-founded. Each time I've chosen to live more authentically, I've been roundly rejected by my everybody committees. There's my old religious committee who will gladly tell you I'm going straight to hell. The intellectual committee who believe I'm a delusional moron. And the classy materialist committee who cannot believe I wear a plastic watch from Target in publicity photos. All these folks are still alive and kicking people who don't share their values, yet every cell of me knows that what they think of me is none of my business. How can I be so blithe about being judged by people whose judgments I once bowed before? Because I have a new everybody committee. Today, my mental operating theater is filled with people so kind and caring, they make Pollyanna look like a total shrew. But so sharp and funny, they won't let me get away with a minute's whining. Am I the luckiest person on earth to have such a committee? No. I'm insanely blessed, but luck had nothing to do with it. I installed my awesome Everybody Committee through deliberate, concerted effort, and you can do the same. How to appoint the right Everybody Committee? Number one, figure out which members of your current committee are working against you. Refer to that list you made above, the negative judgments that haunt you, and write the names of people who've expressed those judgments. Now write the names of anyone who'd judge you harshly if they knew your darkest secret or your heart's desires or what you look like naked. Do not list groups, only individuals. Dealing with actual data instead of your generalizations is the key to making this work. These people no longer get seats on your Everybody Committee. Mentally hand them their pink slips and explain that you're heading in another direction. Then keep following these instructions or the nasties won't leave. Number two, choose one compassionate other to chair your new committee. You may already have someone on your Everybody Committee who loves you absolutely unconditionally. If so, that person may remain as chair of your new committee. If you don't know any unconditionally accepting people, you must find one. This person doesn't actually have to be alive or even human. If you're stumped, consider these candidates. Anyone who treated you with respect and kindness when you were little, a teacher, your nana, Kermit the Frog. Any author, blogger, or performer whose work makes you feel understood and encouraged. Any non-human mammal that loves you, in a pinch, a highly affectionate bird will do. Your higher power. But I'm not talking about a crazy-ass god who loves to hand out one-way tickets to hell. I'm talking about a loving presence that wants nothing but your happiness. If your higher power means anything else to you, replace it with a golden retriever. Number three, use snowball sampling to round out your committee. Snowball sampling is what social scientists use to obtain the opposite of a random sample. That is, a group of people who are linked in certain specified ways. Imagine your new committee chair is a snowball you've packed with your own mittened hands. Now use the snowball to pick up additional like-minded souls by mentally rolling it through the people who are near it. Seek out any cousins who love Nana as much as you did. Chat online with your favorite blogger's fans. Google other parrot owners. Check out congregations that share your spiritual beliefs. Even if it takes a while to connect with these folks, here's the awesome thing. You need only 3 or 4 people to create a new Everybody Committee, to convince your irrational, emotional brain that these people represent the whole world. That is, if you follow the last step. Number four, connect with your new committee members every day for 90 days. Obviously, I stole this idea from AA. Newly recovering alcoholics are encouraged to attend 90 meetings in 90 days because this helps remake their social network, changing boozy or abusive everybodies into people committed to sobriety. It works, people, so take the challenge. Every day for 90 days, spend at least an hour reading, watching, Facebooking, or physically interacting with your new loving, accepting, encouraging Everybody Committee. It'll feel odd at first, but I guarantee it'll grow on you. I begin my current Everybody Committee with a possibly fictional Chinese philosopher who died 2,500 years ago. For months, my committee was composed of dead writers I knew only on paper, but I hung out with them by reading their work every day. I still do, and the more I aligned with their enlightened perspective, the more I found myself connecting to people who are similar to them. That first tiny deceased committee has snowballed into a passel of beloved friends. This is what I want you to experience too. I want you to oust your internal critics, the ones who say you're not good enough, who think you're on the wrong track. I want you to be supervised all day, every day by people who forgive your errors and believe in your destiny. I hope you try this method of achieving that. And if you think that makes me a bit smarmy or completely insane, go right ahead. That's really none of my business. Our next article by Mackenzie Jean Philippe is The 28 Most Anticipated Romance Novels of 2022, Curated by Experts. Romance has long been one of the top-selling genres in adult fiction, but there's no doubt that 2020 only proved to re-emphasize its popularity. As readers around the country were forced to quarantine at home and grapple with the realities of the pandemic and a national racial reckoning, rapid sales growth showed many found refuge in the guaranteed happily ever after of a love story. Fast forward to today, and this fact still rings true with 2022 romance novels. Readers are looking for escapism in their fiction, says Cindy Huang, vice president and editorial director of Berkeley Books, one of the leading publishers of romance fiction. I think that is going to continue. With the state of the world, even when the pandemic is under control, they're looking for books to help them deal. Statistics find that in the midst of societal turmoil, sandwiched between manga and women's fiction, romance has unsurprisingly maintained its spot as one of the highest-selling genres in both print and ebooks. Those who spare the genre a cursory glance condescendingly congratulate its success by praising its forgettability and mocking iconic old-school historical romance covers as cheesy and cheap. But the extremely passionate members of Romancelandia, dedicated authors, readers, bloggers, and podcasters, know there's more to the community than an errant think piece. It reaches far beyond Bridgerton, after all, though we're obsessed with those books, too. The thousands of stories released each year via local bookshelves and our Kindles give way to narratives that come with a mandatory HEA, but they also highlight the complexities that come when those of varying ethnicities, body types, sexual orientation, and gender identities fall in love. And there are acclaimed authors such as Alyssa Cole and Helen Huang, whose leads value the importance of politics and address the struggles of severe burnout. There is an increasing awareness of people having to deal with anxiety and differing levels of mental health, and I think that's reflected now too, Huang says. Reading romance is a more overall positive experience. There is an escapist component to it, but there's a real-life component too. Now going into the new year, Huang explains that trends within the genre that we'll see in the coming months are often extensions of what we find most comforting in the midst of chaos. Contemporary romances are having a moment, with many centered around our most beloved life pleasures, like baking, fake it till you bake it, reality TV, Devon and Chris plan a wedding, and even books themselves, book lovers. Huang even points to the younger readers of TikTok, aka hashtag BookTok, whose enthusiasm and recommendations not only influence book sales, but bolster the subgenres of fantasy and sci-fi. To help you navigate the thriving and ever-growing community, we've consulted six novelists of the genre, and this writer, to recommend their most anticipated and favorite romance novels of 2022. Use these insider opinions to begin the journey of finding your favorite love stories to escape with this year. Recommendations from Katie Robert, best-selling author of Neon Gods. Number 1, The Wedding Crasher by Mia Sosa. The first book in this series blew me away by giving me enemies to lovers, my favorite, without anyone actually being a jerk. I really love Dean as a best friend in the first book, so I'm excited to see him as the hero in this one. And who doesn't love a you shouldn't get married, so I'm going to crash your wedding plotline? Release date March 30th. Number 2, The Final Strife by Sarah Alarifi. I actually found this book because of Tasha Suri's recommendation. I bought it off the promise of a fantasy novel that's sapphic and spicy without even reading the blurb. Then I read the blurb, and suffice to say I will be begging and pleading with the publisher to send me an advance copy. Three women of very different backgrounds are at the center of a story rife with politics and tension, and it promises to be a most excellent read. Release date of June 21st. Number 3, Silkfire by Zabi Ellor. I saw this book pitched as having a polyamorous relationship at the center, plus it has necromancers in space. It's all of my favorite things in a single story, which is downright irresistible. Throw in backbiting politics, and this quickly propelled itself to the top of my anticipated reads for 2022. Release date, July 5th. Recommendations from Nisha Sharma, best-selling author of My So-Called Bollywood Life. Number 1, Camilla Knows Best by Farah Heron. Farah Heron writes a strong story with witty banter and delicious food references, and her sweet with a touch of spice romances. This Emma-inspired friends-to-lovers romance has it all, from Bollywood movie nights to excellent mental health representation. It's hilarity and hijinks. Also, two words, puppy prom. Release date, March 8th. Number 2, Dating Dr. Dill by Nisha Sharma. I am both excited and petrified to finally be able to share Dating Dr. Dill, a reimagining of Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew and the first book in the If Shakespeare Was an Auntie trilogy. The story follows a Taylor Swift-obsessed, love-focused heroine whose world changes when she meets a ridiculous love-phobic hero. I hope you enjoy it. Release date, March 15th. Number 3, A Caribbean Heiress in Paris by Adriana Herrera. What if you took a feminist Afro-Latina who wants to make rum, a Darcy S. Scott who has some land that's perfect for a distillery, and you set it against the backdrop of the Paris World's Fair in 1889? You get Adriana's incredible historical romance with diverse characters that get the sexy, happily ever after they deserve. A Caribbean Heiress is a historical marriage of convenience masterpiece. Release date, May 31st. Recommendations from Kosoko Jackson, best-selling author of adult debut I'm So Not Over You. Number 1, The Roughest Draft by Austin Siegmund Broca and Emily Wibberly. Emily Wibberly and Austin Siegmund Broca are the dream team from heaven. Starting as young adult authors and shifting their powerhouse kingdom into adult, The Roughest Draft absolutely gives me the Hating Game vibes for a new generation, but sweeter. And maybe steamier? We'll have to wait and see, but judging from Emily and Austin's young adult successes, I'm so excited to see how they tackle adult fiction. This title was released on January 25th. Number 2, I'm So Not Over You by Kosoko Jackson. We have to be our biggest advocates, right? I couldn't make a rom-com list without including my own debut. I wrote this novel because I wanted to see queer rom-coms that center black men in love. We deserve the same funny, steamy, and tear-jerking stories as everyone else. Throw in the tropes of second chances and fake dating, and you have, in my humble opinion, a great rom-com. But I'll let you decide that for yourself. This title was released on February 2nd. Number 3, Thank You for Listening by Julia Whelan. Spoiler, this is a Julia Whelan stan account. I loved my Oxford year. I've devoured every book Julia has narrated. Okay, not every, but you get my point. Now Julia is deciding to combine her experience as an audiobook narrator and give us a rom-com that doesn't shy away from the hard-hitting themes of self-acceptance and self-love. Inject it into my veins. This promises to combine Julia's signature searing prose with her exceptional rom-com chops, and I'm here for it. Release date, August 2nd. Recommendations from Mia Sosa, best-selling author of The Worst Best Man. Number 1, Devon and Chris Plan a Wedding by Chensia Higgins. This is a year of the fake relationship trope, and this book is starting us off with a bang. The premise is bonkers in the best way. Chris Zavala is an influencer looking to elevate her brand, while Devon Miller is looking for an opportunity to come out to her family. They both find what they're searching for on the set of a reality television competition show. The challenge? Convince their friends and relatives they're getting married in 6 weeks. The prize? $100,000. Something tells me the real prize, though, will be love. See what I did there? Anyway, the book features weddings, a fake relationship, and reality television. I'm grabbing the popcorn now. This title is released on January 25th. Number 2, A Proposal They Can't Refuse by Natalie Kanya. What do you get when you put together two scheming octogenarians, a determined Puerto Rican chef trying to save her family's restaurant, and an Irish-American whiskey distiller on a mission to make his mark in the world? If you're Natalie Kanya and you're writing your debut, the answer is magic. On the surface, this is a book about two people who agree to fake an engagement to further their own interests, but find love instead. Dig a little deeper, though, and you'll find an homage to the importance of culture, family, and honoring one's legacy. Kanya's world blesses us with messy but lovable relatives, nosy friends, glorious cuisine, and electric chemistry between its two leads. I'm already anxiously awaiting the next installment. Release date, May 3rd. Number 3, West Side Love Story by Priscilla Olivares. Olivares' family-focused romances are always a hit, and I expect West Side Love Story will be no different. This time she puts her unique spin on a well-known tale, pinning a romance about star-crossed lovers Mariana Capuleta and Angelo Montero. The long-standing feud between their relatives means Mariana and Angelo's attraction is forbidden, but the stakes are raised even higher when their families compete against each other in the Battle of the Mariachi Bands. This promises to be an epic story filled with delicious tension, bitter rivalries, and hard-fought redemption, and I'm confident that in Olivares' talented hands, we'll get the satisfying happily ever after we deserve. Release date, May 3rd. Recommendations from Mimi Matthews, a best-selling author of Fair as a Star. Number 1, The Siren of Sussex by Mimi Matthews. I'd be remiss not to mention The Siren of Sussex. Set in 1860s London, it features Ahmed Malik, a gifted half-Indian tailor, and Evelyn Maltravers, the blue-stocking equestrian who enlists him to make her daring riding habits. A love letter to Victorian fashion, horseback riding, romance, and history, it's the first of my novels with a main character who shares my heritage and therefore very close to my heart. This title was released on January 11th. Number 2, The Lady Tempts an Heir by Harper St. George. Harper St. George's Gilded Age Heiresses series is chock full of glittering British ballrooms, stately homes, and American wealth and industry, a suitable backdrop for the strong, independent, and super sexy characters in her stories. I adored the first two novels in this series, and book 3 is sure to enchant. Release date, February 22nd. Number 3, In Search of a Prince by Tony Shiloh. In this heartfelt retelling of the Princess Diaries, Newark public school teacher Brielle is wholly content with her life, until she finds out she may be an African princess. I love a romance populated with characters you can truly root for, and this one has that and more. Coupled with Tony Shiloh's winning voice, it's a story not to be missed. This title was released on February 1st. Recommendations from Christina C. Jones, best-selling author of I Think I Might Love You. Number 1, The Replacements by Shea Sanders. Shea Sanders is a newer voice in Black indie romance and an incoming force to be reckoned with. I've seen nothing but raves about her latest, The Replacements, which follows a soon-to-be divorcee and her grumpy boss. Shay's writing is fresh and humorous, and she delivers in the steam department as well. I can't wait to read this. No release date available. Number 2, New Year, New Sigh by Nicole Falls. I love a good re-becoming of age story, and that is exactly what Nicole brings with New Year, New Sigh. We navigate the aftermath of an extinction-level disaster of a New Year's for Sienna, and spend a year with her as she figures herself out. Nicole consistently brings great comedic timing with her work, but here we get even more layers that give this novel a great balance between women's fiction and pure romance. No release date available. Number 3, Temper Me by Alexandria House. This is the third and final book in the Romy Yu series from the phenomenal Alexandria House. Romy University is a fictional HBCU ripe with culture inspired by the real world, which is always a joy to see in words. I already know this second chance, age gap romance is going to take me on an emotional roller coaster that'll leave me crying into my earbuds. It's an Audible original, so exclusive to audio first. but I also know I can look to Alexandria for scorching intimate scenes to balance it out. I'm excited to see how it all wraps up. Release date to be announced. Recommendations from Mackenzie Jean Philippe, editorial assistant at Oprah Daily. Number 1, Electric Idol by Katie Robert. In the crosshairs of a political war between their respective power-hungry mothers, assassin Eros enters into a marriage of convenience with socialite Psyche in order to save her life. Despite the chaos that arises from their union, the two quickly develop a steamy connection that'll be irresistible to any romance fanatic. A worthy and much-anticipated follow-up to 2021's best-selling Neon Gods, once again, Katie Robert brings us an addicting, delicious, modern retelling of one of Greek mythology's classic love stories. And don't worry, Robert stays true to her tradition of not saving any steamy details for the imagination. This title was released on January 18th. Number 2, Black Love Matters by Jessica P. Pride. Edited by Book Riot columnist and co-host of the When in Romance podcast, this illuminating essay anthology is one of the few texts of the 21st century solely focused on the necessity of Black love in entertainment. From DePaul University professor Julie Moody Freeman, who has made studying Black romance her life's work, to celebrated historical fiction writer Beverly Jenkins, a diverse group of scholars, readers, and writers honestly reflect on the overlooked impact of desire and happily ever afters in pop culture in the Black community. This title was released on February 1st. Number 3, Book Lovers by Emily Henry. After releasing two New York Times bestsellers, Beach Read and People We Meet on Vacation, for the third year in a row, Emily Henry brings us another charming summer romance. Book Lovers has all the ingredients of what has now become a Henry classic. A complicated hero and heroine, ensconced in the literary world, whose will-they-won't-they romance plays out against the backdrop of a dreamy high-temp locale. This time we get to know intense literary agent Nora Stevens and moody editor Charlie Lastra. Both are coincidentally on holiday in the same small North Carolina town, meaning whether they like it or not, they bump into each other. A lot. Release date, May 3rd. Number 4, You Made a Fool of Death with Your Beauty by Awake Emezi. The author of the much-acclaimed autobiography Freshwater and New York Times best-selling The Death of Vivek Oji brings us their debut romance. With a title that's named for a verse in Florence and the Machine's angsty ballad Hunger, the literary novel introduces us to our heroine, Feyi Adekola. Feyi is a grief-stricken artist struggling to recover from the tragic death of her husband. But as she starts dating again and jets off on a dreamy Caribbean getaway, her budding love life becomes complicated. In 2021, You Made Me a Fool of Death with Your Beauty was thrust into a competitive bidding war for its screen rights. Amazon Studios eventually won out, with Michael B. Jordan's production company, Outlier Society, signing on to develop it for the screen. Release date, May 24th. Our next article is titled, Build Your Confidence in 5 Seconds. Really? Imagine walking into a room feeling self-assured and at ease. Imagine radiating confidence. The good news? It's possible to be that person. Confidence is a skill that can be built, just like a muscle, and it's possible to start exercising it now. Below, we've gathered a few exercises designed to help you start turning heads. The following techniques can be completed in under an hour, many in only a few seconds. From spritzing perfume to practicing good posture, these moves may change your mindset for the better. If you have 1 second, sit up straight. Research suggests that people with good posture have more confidence in their thoughts than slouchers. If you have 2 seconds, practice good sense. One study found that women felt more confident in social, business, and romantic situations when wearing perfume. If you have 3 seconds, knock wood. Psychologists have shown that embracing superstitions and carrying good luck charms can help you perform better. If you have 5 seconds, nod along. When you nod your head when listening to someone, research has shown that your belief in what you're thinking is heightened. If you have 10 seconds, flirt. Social psychologist Laura Cray, PhD, has said that smiling, laughing, and engaging in slight physical contact when negotiating can help you win the day. If you have 10 minutes, focus on your breathing. Those who regularly practice Buddhist mindfulness meditation report increased self-acceptance. If you have 15 minutes, grab a cup of joe. One more reason to love your latte? 100 milligrams of caffeine has been known to increase alertness, energy, and confidence. If you have 20 minutes, break a sweat. Science long ago proved that exercise enhances your mood. But did you know a 20-minute workout can sharpen your state of mind for a whopping 12 hours? If you have 1 hour, assemble a confidence toolbox. Carol Dweck, PhD, professor of psychology at Stanford University and author of Mindset, The New Psychology of Success, says that a well-chosen array of objects can give you a major morale boost. Provided you keep them hidden away in a drawer or a bookshelf, says Dweck, so that when you come upon them or seek them out, their associations are still potent. Here's what to include in your collection. Proof that you could be bold. Did you keep the phone number your husband gave you after you asked him out? Or the party hat you wore when you started a conga line at a friend's birthday bash? Letting loose makes you feel assertive, says Dweck, so hang on to evidence that you know how to bust out of your shell. A photo of those closest to you. Feeling loved is a source of strength, says Dweck, in part because it provides a social safety net. You're more likely to take a leap when you know there are people who will catch you if you fall. A symbol of a new endeavor. Something like a French to English dictionary if you're learning a new language, or a snapshot if you're taking photography. You can derive confidence from the fact that you're pushing yourself, Dweck says. A token of improvement. Were you once hopeless at finishing crosswords, but now you're acing the Sunday edition? Or maybe you couldn't run a block 6 months ago, but you just completed a 5K. If so, don't pitch that puzzle or your number from the race. Quantifiable achievements provide an instant jolt of self-esteem because they make it easy to measure progress. A biography or magazine profile of your idol. Dweck has her students research personal heroes to learn how they become successful. The students get inspired because they see that everyone has setbacks, she says. An invitation to an upcoming social event. Reminders of future get-togethers bring to mind relationships with loved ones. And, says Dweck, looking forward to something keeps you focused on good things to come. And finally, a token from a time you were there for someone. Say, a thank you note from a friend. Contributing to another person's life boosts self-esteem, especially when it helps them make progress toward their own goals, says Dweck. Our next article by Holly Carter is titled, The Grown Woman's Guide to Online Dating. Once upon a time, internet dating was a vaguely embarrassing pursuit. Who wanted to be one of those lonely hearts trolling the singles bars of cyberspace? These days, however, the New York Times Vows section, famous for its meet-cute stories of the blissfully betrothed, is full of couples who trumpet the love they found through OkCupid or Tinder. Today, an estimated one-third of marrying couples in the U.S. met online, and as many as 15% of American adults have used dating sites or apps. Even Martha Stewart, who in 2013 declared in her Match profile that she was looking for a lover of animals, grandchildren, and the outdoors. Martha, have you considered Raya, the private celebrity dating app? Locking eyes across a crowded room might make for a lovely song lyric, but when it comes to romantic potential, nothing rivals technology, according to Helen Fisher, PhD, a biological anthropologist, senior research fellow at the Kinsey Institute, and chief scientific advisor to Match. It's more possible to find someone now than at probably any other time in history, particularly if you're older. You don't have to stand in a bar and wait for the right one to come along, says Fisher. And we found that people looking for a sweetheart on the internet are more likely to have full-time employment and higher education, and to be seeking a long-term partner. Online dating is the way to go. You just have to learn to work the system. So take heart. Whether you're a first-time player or a seasoned contestant who wants to up her game, our troubleshooting guide is here to help with advice from both experts and survivors on how to search strategically, handle setbacks gracefully, maintain sanity, and enjoy the ride with minimal agony and maximum ecstasy. Your eligible bachelor awaits. How to get better at online dating. For guidance, O Style features director Holly Carter turned to a pro. 7 years ago, I signed up for Match.com, but I never took it seriously. For me, online dating is like exercise. At the end of the day, it's easier to watch TV. But at 44, I started to realize that if I want a companion before Social Security kicks in, I have to leave the couch. I needed a trainer, someone who could help me focus. Only instead of getting defined abs, I'd get a mate, hopefully with defined abs. Enter Damona Hoffman, dating coach and host of the Dates and Mates podcast, who promises rapid results if I just follow a few tough love rules. Treat it like it's your job. The first thing Hoffman tells me, this takes time and attention. I want you to be on the site at least 3 hours a week. Uh-oh, that's 3 episodes of The Center. Put style in your profile. Kindly, Hoffman refrains from mocking my unassisted self-description. I'm a loving person who likes trying new restaurants and a sweet treat before bed. I never realized how dirty that sounds. She asks about my hobbies, how my coworkers would fill in the most likely to blank. She then revises my profile, noting that I love cooking vegetables I grow in my garden, that Dave Chappelle has my kind of humor, that meeting new people excites me. I could spend half an hour talking to the cashier at Trader Joe's. 3/4 of the profile should be about me and the other quarter about what I want in a mate, says Hoffman, who tells me to be specific here too. The goal isn't to attract everyone, it's to find the one. We come up with, my ideal match is someone who loves family, has an opinion on current events, and can hold his own at a cocktail party on a Friday night, then chill with me on a lazy Saturday. The final touch is a headline that sums up my approach to life like a personal slogan. Hoffman suggests family, kindness, friends, faith. That's what I value most. I'm spiritual and go to church, but faith sounds heavy. I swap it for fun. Work your angles. Hoffman looks at my photos and nixes the corporate headshot and mirror selfie. You want to look natural and inviting. Mirror selfies often give off an air of vanity. She says the best profile shots feature the 3 C's. Color, vibrant shades, especially red, grab attention. Context, pics that involve your hobbies like travel or, say, clog dancing. And character, something quirky or funny like you in your Halloween costume. For the main photo, we do a close headshot where I'm smiling into the camera. For the others, we do one of me outside in a green dress, one where I'm wearing something sparkly, and another where I'm standing on an escalator. This doesn't reveal much about me besides my aversion to stairs, but it's a full body shot, which Hoffman recommends. Agreed, as a curvy girl, I want to avoid first date surprises. I skip quirky. I haven't worn a Halloween costume since I went as a pack of grape Hubba Bubba in 6th grade. Take charge. One reason I've been passive about online dating, most of the guys have been a little conservative for my taste. When you're a black woman in your 40s, why do all your matches look like George Jefferson? Hoffman says the algorithm, like a boyfriend, can't read my mind. I need to message and like guys I find appealing if I want to start seeing similar people in my results. Plus, being more active should bump my profile toward the top so I'll be more visible. I should make my messages personal, advises Hoffman. Comment on something in his profile and follow with a question. Dutifully, I tell one bespeckled prospect, I like melty ice cream too. What's your favorite flavor? I have some interesting chats, but nothing leads anywhere. After a lengthy back and forth with a cute guy who asks why I'm still single, beats me, I try a Hoffman move, writing, "That's a story better told over a drink." He suggests chicken fingers. As in fast food? Is this a sex thing I don't know about? But then success. Someone likes me and asks me out within three messages. He's into photography and makes his own pasta, and he is an Adonis. We have a short phone call, as Hoffman recommends, to set something up. His voice is velvety, but I'm skeptical. That's online dating. You meet the freakazoids and think, this is the worst. You find someone great and think, am I going to be on the next episode of Catfish? Don't rush it. On the day of the date, I meet him at a restaurant. Hoffman wouldn't approve. She said to make the first date a quick drink, 1 hour max, but when Hunkamania suggested dinner, I couldn't resist. He's just as swoon-worthy in person as his photos. I'm supposed to focus on how I feel, not on the package, but it's hard when the package is so beautifully wrapped. He's sweet, too, talking about his grandma, and we follow dinner with drinks. By the time he drops me off at my door, I've exceeded my time limit by 3 hours and 32 minutes. It's kind of like blowing a diet. You know what you're supposed to do, but then you see dessert and willpower goes out the window. I realize I got lucky that this was the dating equivalent of finding a magical unicorn. Plenty of my friends do online dating like it's an Olympic sport, and they've had the most romantic evenings of their lives with guys who then promptly vaporize into the Earth's atmosphere. But whatever happens, it feels good to be back in the game. I decide to message Mr. Chicken Fingers, knowing I shouldn't put all my eggs in one basket. How to increase your odds of finding a match. Meet 9 people. Our brains are best equipped to handle 5 to 9 options. Any more and we go into cognitive overload. At that point, you just start looking for reasons to say no, like, look at his ugly shoes, says Fisher. Pick 9, meet in person, then take a break while you get to know at least one. Set 3 deal breakers. If there's something you truly can't tolerate, smoking for instance, okay, but I give clients a limit, says House. Most people focus on wants, hot, funny. You find the right one when you focus on needs, communication, mutual respect. Give it 3 dates. Even if you don't feel chemistry, says House, chemistry doesn't last. Attraction is important, but if someone meets your needs, you may find the attraction follows. How to find the best dating platform for you. If you seek wedded bliss, eHarmony. Answer an in-depth survey based on 29 dimensions of compatibility, e.g. humor, physical energy, communication style. Then get a new list of potential soulmates regularly. No searching required. If you seek other grown-ups, match. Don't worry, someone here will get your pop culture references. 39% of match users are in the 37 to 52 age group, and 27% are between 53 and 72. If you seek the hip crowd, OkCupid. An entertaining questionnaire, do you believe in dinosaurs is a question, and open options. Look for anything from a partner to a polyamorous paramour. If you seek the driver's seat, Bumble. With this app, every night is ladies' night. Swipe right on an attractive gentleman, and if he's interested, it's up to you to make the first move. If you seek maximum efficiency, Tinder. The swipe surge feature, available in select cities, alerts you when the app is getting a lot of action, so you can get some too. If you seek a date with destiny, Happn. This geolocation-based app shows you well-matched users who are close by. Check your timeline to find hot prospects who have recently crossed your path. If you seek a big pond, Plenty of Fish. Cast a really wide net on this free site with more than 150 million users. Quiz lovers will dig the cheekily revealing questions about relationship needs and seduction styles. Now we'll hear some true confessions from online daters. We're perfect, but their profile is still up. Hold off on the talk until the 3-month mark, which gives him a chance to form an attachment, advises psychiatrist Ish Major, MD, co-host of WeTV's Marriage Bootcamp Reality Stars. And at that point, if he shares your feelings, you'll be more comfortable defining expectations. If he doesn't, it's maybe time to think about moving on. He said we'd have great kids and later texted, "Are we a couple?" It was our first date. If you don't want to ghost or fake your death, says Barrett, text back, "I had a great time, but I've had a couple of dates with someone else and I'd like to see where it goes. But there's an amazing woman out there who will be lucky to get you." They sent a Venmo request for my half of the bill. "That's not only unchivalrous, but passive aggressive," says Barrett. "When this happened to a friend of mine, she sent the entire amount with a note that said, 'Looks like you need this more than I do.'" They're cute, they're fun, they vanished. Ghosting happens to the best of us, says therapist and dating coach Melanie Hirsch. To stay sane, she says, stop telling yourself stories to explain it, like, "It's because I'm not good enough." Trying to figure out why someone didn't choose you is like trying to swim with ankle weights. You'll get pulled right down instead of moving forward. Let him disappear and make way for the partner you deserve. The photo was dreamy. The reality, scary. If they're older, paunchier, have more neck bolts than he does in the photos, choose compassion, says New York dating coach Cannell Barrett. He probably lied because it's a sore spot. Just have one polite drink. Who knows? You may wind up charmed, and it is the human thing to do. He sent a really personal photo. Why does a man have to text a pic of his penis when hello would suffice? One possible explanation offered by Justin Leimaller, PhD, research fellow at the Kinsey Institute and author of Tell Me What You Want, is that men tend to overestimate the sexual interest of women they casually encounter, so they may assume the gift will be welcome. And if they occasionally get a positive response, they may figure it can't hurt to try again. In psychology research, we call this a variable reinforcement schedule, Leimaller says. It's like a slot machine. The majority of the time you pull the lever and nothing happens, but every once in a while there's a payoff. A deflating solution from one online dater? Draw a face on it and send it back to him. I got a surprise phone call from their wife. Married daters are more common than we'd like to think, says dating coach Laurel House, host of the podcast The Man Whisperer. Her tip? A little pre-date due diligence is smart. Do a Google image search with his photo to see if it links to a Facebook or Instagram account. This can also protect you from scam artists. Be wary if the photos seem too perfect or his language is considerably more fluent in his profile than in his messages. And if he tells you he lost his wallet and needs a loan, run. Our next article by Mary Grace Taylor is titled, "This Inspiring Cancer Patient is a Mastectomy Tattoo Artist and Activist." Beth Fairchild had been a tattoo professional for 20 years, but the work she does is anything but what most people expect. The 40-year-old specializes in areola tattoos for breast cancer patients who've undergone breast cancer reconstructive surgery. Areola tattoos use color and shading to create an illusion of a 3D nipple protruding from the breast. They're often sought out as an alternative to nipple restoration, a lengthy surgical procedure that some patients prefer to avoid. Nipple restoration doesn't always work or look very natural. It might also not be a good fit for patients with skin issues or skin trauma from cancer surgery, Fairchild explains. Patients typically come to Fairchild around 6 months after undergoing breast reconstruction, once they've fully healed. "We'll numb the area and select and mix the colors for the areola," she says. "Then I draw on the desired shape and size and tattoo the areola. The entire procedure takes about 2 hours." Fairchild's connection to breast tattoos is deeply personal. When she was 20, her mother underwent a lumpectomy for breast cancer that resulted in the removal of half her nipple. She didn't choose to reconstruct. "Seeing my mom's breast deformed from that procedure made me realize this is what breast cancer does to women, and I knew there was a need for this kind of tattooing," she says. Already working as a conventional tattoo professional for the past 10 years, Fairchild sought out specialized permanent cosmetics training, including areola restoration and scar camouflage. I took the knowledge I got from the training and applied it to what I knew about skin and mixing colors, and I just started putting it out there, she says. Her early clients found her by word of mouth, and it wasn't long before word began to spread. Now she's a go-to specialist near the Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina area. Fairchild lives on the state's coast, and hospitals in the region refer breast cancer patients to her. From the start, Fairchild loved getting to know her clients and knowing that she was making a difference in their quality of life. I love the intimate relationship that we get to create, she says. I love sending them away with this lasting thing and knowing that they'll always remember the interaction. Then life took a shocking turn. In 2014, Fairchild herself was diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer, stage 4 breast cancer that can't be cured. Prior to her diagnosis, Fairchild had complained to her doctor about unusual abdominal bloating that had been going on for several months. Her doctor ordered a CT scan that revealed bone, liver, and ovary lesions. The scan also showed that her ovaries had grown to the size of grapefruits. Since they were on the verge of rupturing, Fairchild opted to have them removed. When she woke up from the surgery, Fairchild's doctor told her that her enlarged ovaries and lesions were the result of breast cancer that had spread throughout her body, and it was worse than the scans had indicated. The cancer had spread to every part of her body, including her uterus, cervix, and the entire top of her vagina. My entire pelvic cavity was fused with cancer, so they had to take everything out during the surgery, she says. Fairchild was told that she had 2 years to live, even with the best treatment options. She knew that she wanted to spend time with her family and travel as much as she could, but she also wanted to keep on working. Focusing on helping others through tattooing, along with breast cancer-related advocacy work she'd soon take on, drove her to keep moving forward instead of dwelling on her disease. Not wanting to cast a shadow over her clients' cancer journeys, Fairchild opted to keep quiet about her MBC at first. They were coming to me because they had just experienced this thing and my work was part of their healing process. I didn't want to tell them that I had terminal cancer, she says. But listening to clients with highly treatable early-stage cancers open up about their struggles was hard. They'd talk about how they didn't feel attractive anymore because of how their breasts looked. I thought to myself, if you knew the other side, if you were stage 4 and you knew you were going to die, you wouldn't even care about what your breasts look like, Fairchild says. Fairchild knew she needed to connect with patients like her who were dealing with MBC. So she joined an online support group a few months after her diagnosis, where she was finally able to meet others she could relate to. Getting involved with the online NBC community led Fairchild to take notice of the ways that some people strove to bring awareness to breast cancer, and she found a lot of the tactics to be frivolous. Someone posted a pink tractor that they were taking around to raise awareness, so I said to the group, the $60,000 spent on this tractor could have been used for research that would help people stay alive, Fairchild says. As someone who's dying, I'd forgo all the support in the world for more research dollars. In an effort to get the public to focus more on the need for NBC research funding and less on pink cancer-themed products, Fairchild launched the virtual protest Stomp Out BC. She and other NBC patients designed sobering graphics to clearly illustrate how much time each had left to live. One of them might have 3 Christmas trees or Easter eggs to represent the average number of holidays I had left, she says. They began sharing the graphics in March 2015 on social media, tagging hashtag #DontIgnoreStage4, and the movement quickly went viral with the hashtag trending on both Facebook and Twitter. Beth quickly became NBC's best-known advocate, getting featured in magazines and on TV shows. She also accepted an offer to serve as vice president of the NBC nonprofit MetaViver. The organization is dedicated to increasing research on advanced breast cancer as well as patient support. I never thought advocacy was my thing, but I knew how to tell my story, Fairchild says, and people listened. When I was first diagnosed in 2014, there was nothing about metastatic breast cancer anywhere. Now you can go to any advocacy group and they have a whole space for MBC, she says. That includes MetaViver. We're constantly publishing about new drugs, reliable resources, studies, and clinical trials, as well as sharing patients' journeys, especially women of color who aren't getting the treatment they deserve. And thanks in part to her efforts, the nonprofit raised $6.2 million for NBC Research in 2019 alone. Beth's role has changed since stepping into the advocacy space in 2015. Now a past president of MetaViver, she's taken on a leadership role with the media platform #Cancerland, which uses photography and video to address breast cancer's often ignored realities. We'll share our content on social channels and people will learn new things, like how an 18-year-old can be diagnosed with MBC, or that women who still have their hair can have MBC, Fairchild explains. That helps us gain momentum and build donations. While working as a spokesperson and storyteller, Fairchild had continued to do tattoos, and her relationship with her clients has evolved. Now I'm open and honest about my MBC, and most of my clients come and find me because of that, she says. Now with someone I'm just meeting, we can talk about the most intimate details of our lives, and I automatically know they understand me and vice versa, she says. When I'm giving someone a permanent tattoo, it's a big deal to have that kind of rapport. 6 years after her diagnosis, Beth's MBC hasn't advanced. I still have cancer, but it's not doing anything. It's just kind of hanging out. It's pretty miraculous that I'm still alive and still healthy, she says. Arthritis caused by her cancer meds means her joints are always in pain, and some days she needs more downtime than others, which can sometimes make it hard for her to work. But she vows she'll keep doing what she can for as long as she can. I need something to work towards, she says. That's what keeps me going. It keeps me hanging on. For information and resources on living with metastatic breast cancer, or how to support someone who is, including a treatment discussion guide, visit findyourmbcvoice.com. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.